Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Monday, February 25th. My name is Rob Doster. I have a fun conversation on the way for you today. It is the Monday Overreactions Podcast, and I was joined by my friend from The Athletic, from the Game Theory Podcast, Sam Vecini, to break down everything that happened in college basketball this weekend. We talked about Michigan State's win at Michigan. We talked about whether or not North Carolina is one of the top five teams in all of college basketball. We got into the Big 12 race, specifically whether or not Texas Tech can go out and win a national title. And we also discussed Tennessee's loss at LSU and whether or not Tennessee can actually win six games in March when it matters. Two things before I get into the podcast itself. One, if you like what you hear on this podcast today, please rate, please review, please subscribe to this podcast in any app that you listen to podcasts in. Any interaction that you have with this podcast, whether it's downloading or rating or reviewing or subscribing, all of that helps. It helps us in the metrics. It helps us in the rankings. It helps makes my bosses happy. And when my bosses are happy, I'm happy. When I'm happy, you are getting a better show. So really giving me five stars and saying something nice about me is only going to help you in the long run. The other thing I wanted to do was I wanted to make mention of what happened at Ole Miss on Saturday. For those that aren't aware, eight Ole Miss basketball players took a knee during the national anthem of their game at home against Georgia as a protest and a demonstration against a Confederate rally that was being held in Oxford at the exact same time as their game was being played. First and foremost, I want to give credit to the players for being brave enough to take this stance. For those that don't know, back in May, after Kermit Davis was hired as the new head coach of the Ole Miss Rebels, he said at an introductory press conference that, among other things, his team was going to respect the flag and respect the anthem. These players took a knee during the anthem without letting their coach know beforehand, and that is not an easy thing to do, considering that they play at a school whose nickname is the Rebels, or named after Confederate soldiers. The other people I want to give credit to are Kermit Davis and Ole Miss Athletic Director Ross Bjork. They work at a university that, as I mentioned, is named the Rebels in Mississippi. They probably have a very large percentage of their fan base that feels a certain type of way about protests that happen during the anthem, especially when it comes to players kneeling. They came out after the game and completely supported these athletes 100%, knowing what kind of heat was going to come on them from their fans and potentially internally from the school based on what these players did. So I think you have to give them credit for that as well, because these players are not going to be in an easy situation playing for a fan base that, like I said, has a large percentage of people that probably feel a certain type of way about protests that occur during the anthem. But one thing I do want to note, and I hope people understand this, and I hope that the listeners of this podcast are smart enough to get this distinction, but this was not a protest of the national anthem. This was not a protest of the American flag. This was a protest of the hate groups that made their way into Oxford, Mississippi, where these players who are African American were playing a basketball game on that same day on that same campus. This was a demonstration against a Confederate rally that was happening in their homes and where they live. And I don't think I should have to tell you guys this, but the Confederacy, what that was built on, was a war to try to ensure that people of the South would be able to own blacks as slaves. That is what these players were protesting. That is what these players were demonstrating against. And they did it during the national anthem. That is a very, very important distinction to make. And I also think that it's important to say that protests are not meant to be comfortable. If Brian Tyree or Devontae Shuler or any of those other players that were brave enough to do this had written something on their shoes or had put on a t-shirt or had held a sign during the anthem, nobody would have cared. Nobody would have noticed. if Colin Kaepernick had done nothing but wear a t-shirt during the anthem, nobody would be talking about any of this. The point is to raise awareness. The point is to increase the level of discussion. The point of a protest is to do what you can to try to affix change on what you think needs to be changed. The point is not to make people feel comfortable about what you are protesting or how you are protesting. So just keep that in mind. The problem with this entire discussion is that the narrative has been taken over that this is a protest of the anthem and a protest of the flag, and that's not what it is. They are protesting something completely different, and they are doing it while the anthem is being played and the flag is being displayed. It is not meant to be disrespectful to the troops. It is not meant to be disrespectful to the flag or anything. These Ole Miss players were protesting the fact that there was a rally for the Confederacy on their campus, in their hometowns, in the place that they live, and they did it at this time. And I commend them for that. Now let's get into that conversation with Sam Vecenie. And now let me welcome back onto the podcast one Mr. Sam Vecenie. You know him from The Athletic. You know him from the Game Theory podcast. And you now know him as a foster cat owner. Sam, what's going on, man? You got a devil cat in your house now?
So, no, definitely not a devil cat. Incredibly nice cat. But, so it's funny. Yesterday, I text you. You know, you're watching the Michigan game and, you know, whatever happens. And it was like in our group thread or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, like, I don't know what's going on in the Michigan game. Like, I just got a foster cat. Laura and I strongly believe in, like, you know, giving cats a break from the shelter. So anytime that we get a chance to foster cats and, you know, have them mix with our dog and two cats, like, you know, we're going to do it. But here's problem with the way that we went about it yesterday. So our idea was, you know, we'll just like put it in our room and let it get its bearings and figure itself out, get comfortable in our apartment. The problem was that apparently it had had like such a traumatic day. I guess it had driven in the car for like 2 hours and then like, you know, was just dog tired and annoyed and frustrated that every time we went near it yesterday, it just hissed at us like crazy. It hissed at us. So we were concerned about sleeping in our bed. So luckily we have a futon in the living room, or not a futon, like a pull-out bed in the living room. So last night, because we put our foster cat in our bedroom, the foster cat took over our bedroom essentially and is now the sole proprietor of our bedroom, and Laura and I are stuck sleeping out on the couch right now, at least for last night, probably tonight as well. Having said that, the cat is much nicer. He allows it to come near, or allows us to come near him. Like, he will accept like us touching him now, so we're hoping that maybe we won't have to sleep on the couch tonight. But I also just had this massive work project get released today that I'm still like kind of working through, and you know, college basketball is going crazy. So I am working however many hours a week. We have a foster cat. Oh, by the way, the Oscars just happened like what, 6 blocks from my apartment like yesterday. And that's something that I intensely care about. So it's been a very busy like 24 hours in my life.
So before we get into the project you just released, I have a little story. I happen to own a cat that we adopted back when I was still running Ballin' as a Habit. Troy and I were cat owners together when we lived in an apartment in Washington, D.C. And the problem with this cat is that she is mean as all hell to everyone except for me, my wife, my son, and oddly enough, the woman that comes and cleans our house every other week. She loves the four of us and despises everybody else. And this was a problem when we lived in an apartment or when we lived in a townhouse where there wasn't anywhere for the cat to go to kind of get away from things. But now we live in a house with a finished basement, and the cat just has made the basement her little sanctuary. The problem with that is, so the anyone that goes down there that's not us is not as welcome as they probably would like to be with this devil cat around there. And that is also where, so we have a guest room, but if the guest room is taken and we have more than a couple of people staying at the house, the next spot you go to is the couch downstairs in the basement.
And that becomes a problem with the cat because it attacks people. Like if it, one, it just attacks people in general. And two, if like you're under a blanket and it sees toes moving or something like that, it'll attack your toes. And she has no problem with biting. She has her claw still because I strongly believe in not declawing cats. So it'll come claws out, teeth out straight for your toes. And there was one time when Jeff Borzello, who works at ESPN, stayed at our house when there was an event in Philly. The guest room was taken. He slept in the basement, and he got roughly 45 minutes of sleep that night because he spent the whole night getting absolutely terrorized by the cat. And he has not been back since. He's been invited, but he hasn't been back since. And I don't know if he'll ever be back again.
Yeah, I don't blame Borzello for that one. Yeah, cats are – I love cats. Cats are great. I love dogs. Dogs are great. Animals are fantastic. But you really – with cats, you have to take a lot of time or else they are just not ever going to want to be around you, like, period. You have to – like, there – our one cat is pretty sociable around, like, people that just come over for, like, parties and stuff. But the other one will hide in our like bedroom closet because he just does not want to deal with anything.
Yeah, and I wish that our cat would just hide. What she does is she attacks people and she goes flying at them. She draws blood and she is a very, very mean cat. I like to tell myself that she's just protective. She's trying to watch the house and keep everybody safe, which works because we got a dog that was supposed to be kind of scary if any intruders happen to come into the house, who happens to be the friendliest dog of all time. And it, you know, if they're she'll scare somebody off because she'll come running at you, but it's not because she's barking or biting or trying to run somebody out of the house. It's just because she wants to jump on you to lick you, to give you kisses.
That's incredible.
So we don't have a guard dog. We have a guard cat.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is fantastic.
Tell me about the project. Let people know about it because I know you put a lot of time into this and it's actually it's pretty good stuff.
So over the last 3 weeks or something like that, I had this idea that I would reach out. At first, it started at like 35 to 40 coaches and get in-depth scouting reports on all of the players that are NBA draft prospects that they have played. It ended up ballooning into 50 because I just assumed that like if I got 35, 40, the right mix of conferences, I would hit everyone that I needed. It ended up being that I had to like kind of backtrack. And then like for instance, I didn't talk to enough coaches that had played Villanova. I'd only talked to one, I think, and then had to backtrack and then like talk to other coaches that had played Villanova. There was who else? I think San Diego State might have been on that list as well. So it ended up being that I talked to 50 coaches that had played these NBA prospects. And the goal here was simply to get unbiased scouting reports from the assistant coaches that scouted games and have played these elite level kids, just in terms of gaining insight into how they go about trying to stop them, how they go about evaluating them as players, what their strengths are, what their tendencies are, what their weaknesses are. And then ultimately, do they think that they have next level potential? Because, you know, look, college coaches have been around basketball in many cases for decades. So it's a real wealth of knowledge to be able to chat with them and have conversations with them. And, you know, it ended up being that my document that I have here has like 60,000 words, I think. It's like the recordings have like over 1800 words of like, you know, recorded material that I have and had to like transcribe. It's just a lot of lot going on, basically a lot of fun stuff. And I'm very thankful to The Athletic that they essentially let me go like, you know, 2 weeks only writing like two stories so that I could focus on this and really get it done.
It's pretty awesome. You guys definitely need to go check it out. Let me ask you this, Sam, because I know I don't want to have any spoilers, but I do want to tell me like what player or players did you have your mind changed about the most after having these conversations? Was there somebody where you were like, nah, this dude is terrible, and you talked to all these coaches and like, yeah, you know what, maybe he's actually pretty good? Or was there someone that you thought was good and you're like, nah, you know what, he f-ing sucks?
Yes, there are a few. So Coby White stands out. I ended up getting so much material on Coby White that I just split him. I'm splitting him out into his own story, basically. I was assuming that I just throw him in with like all of the other freshmen and stuff that will be coming out. But every single coach, and I talked to more coaches about North Carolina than I did any other team, because more than Coby, I wanted to see what people thought of Nasir Little. And I also have a Nasir Little breakout coming tomorrow, too. But basically, everyone said Coby White is really f-ing good. And then, like, I talked to a lot of coaches about just that have played Roy Williams, you know, teams over the years, you know, how difficult they think it is to play point guard for him as a freshman. And I came away just really, really impressed with that Coby White has been able to accomplish this year. And look, like, he's gonna have his ups and downs. He was terrible against Kentucky. He was pretty bad against Duke, in my opinion. I think he had like 5 turnovers against Gonzaga, but overall I think he's making the right strides, I guess is the way to put it.
Yeah, and he fits really well into what Roy Williams wants out of a point guard, because that role, you got to be able to make some reads and make some plays and hit ahead and transition and all that. But it's always been kind of more of like a little bit of a scoring guard role more than just like a pure playmaker. You know, Joel Berry, he was not a pure point guard by any stretch of the imagination. I would make the argument that Marcus Page and Theo Pinson played more of the playmaking role for North Carolina over the recent seasons when they kind of had all their success when Joel Berry was there. And I think that, you know, this is a little bit off topic, but I think one of the biggest issues with this North Carolina team is they don't really have someone that can kind of take on that playmaking role to make things easier for other people. I think that's part of the reason why Luke May is not having the season that many expected. And I think that Coby White's ability to kind of take on some of that scoring load has made it so we don't really see it in terms of the wins and losses that North Carolina has. Now, that said, like, Coby White, the way that he plays is always going to be inherently a little bit streaky. You know, he's a high volume shooter and like a tough shot maker when it comes down to it at his heart. So those guys are never going to be somebody that you always just count on for 20 points every single night. Sometimes they're going to get you 33. Sometimes they're going to go 3-for-14 against Trey Jones. So I think that's just kind of inherently what he is. And it's part of the reason I think North Carolina is a little bit of a streaky team, which is a perfect segue into the first overreaction that I wanted to get in with you, in my mind, there are 5 teams in college basketball that we can call like the elite of the elite, the national title favorites, whatever phrase you want to use. There's like there's a top 5. I think 4 of them are obvious: Duke, Virginia, Gonzaga, and Kentucky. I don't think anybody would disagree with any of that. I do think that some might disagree with having North Carolina in that conversation. Give me your full take on these Tar Heels after the week that they had, where they went into Cameron Indoor Stadium and beat the hell out of Duke. I think it was, what was it? They won by 16 points when Zion wasn't
88-72, yep.
And then on Saturday, they whipped up on Florida State. I don't even remember what the final score was. I stopped watching that game about midway through the second half because it was very clear that Florida State was not coming back.
Shout out to the Durham disaster.
The Durham disaster.
Wednesday night. Geez. As it will forever be coined in our text chain. Yeah, with Carolina, it's funny that you have framed the question this way, because I went out with Mark Titus on Saturday night, and, you know, Mark is everyone's favorite internet podcaster. He's the best. And
that's
we
a hell
literally
of a name drop right there.
The same exact conversation. We had the same exact conversation as what you're having, and we had the same exact teams as this being the 5. These are the 5 teams. And I like kind of threw in, do I think Michigan is in that mix? And this was on Saturday, so it was before the game on Sunday, where a Nick Ward-less, Josh Langford-less Michigan State team went into Chrysler and beat them. But, like, I still think Michigan can get there if they can get more consistent just creation and shooting at the end of the day. Whether or not they have that skill set in their toolbox, I actually don't know. But I think that you're correct in saying that those are the 5 teams, and that, yes, I would put North Carolina in those 5, in that group of 5.
Are you worried at all about some of that inconsistency and some of the the fact that they go up and down a little bit. Because the thing that was really encouraging to me, I think more than anything else, was that I don't think Coby White really played all that well in either of those two games. You know, in at North Carolina or at Duke, it was Luke May who went for like 30 and 15. And I think Cam Johnson had 27 or whatever it was. And then it was kind of Nazir Little that popped off and had the big game against Florida State. Like, he started dunking on people. I don't think I've seen him dunk on anybody yet this season. And then he caught Fiondu Cabangele with – he just punched it all over him in the first half. I think that was the first time where I was watching a game that North Carolina played, and I did – you know the reaction when somebody dunks and you kind of sit back in your chair like, oh, one of those? That's the first time I had one of those with Nazir Little, I think, this season when I was watching the game live. So, yeah, it's nice to
see
that.
He's had a couple of, like, random putbacks this year, but never, like – never like driving dunks where he just like
catching a body.
Down.
He caught a body,
you know? Yeah. He's had like a couple putbacks that are pretty nasty, but that's, I agree with you. Like this was Nasir's best game. And if they start getting that consistently from him, their ceiling changes from they're a top five team to, I think they are the probably second or third most talented team in the country. I would throw Duke and Gonzaga probably in the top two right now. I really believe in Gonzaga's front court. I believe in them getting Killian Tilly back at some point and Tilly making an impact, in making them in a lot of ways matchup proof whenever he gets back, because I think that what you can do with Gonzaga right now is you might be able to press them and speed them up a little bit, but when Tilly comes back, Tilly's so good at breaking the press and, you know, just throwing him the ball, and he'll make great decisions. He can handle it, 6'10". He spaces the floor for them, which is something they desperately need right now, just beyond who they have in their front court, because Rui's not the best shooter, kind of a non-threat from outside right now. So I look at them as the team that is in that mix. But if North Carolina gets consistent Nasir Little, I mean, it's hard to say who's more talented than that group is, because they have a lot of really, really great kids, and we have not mentioned Cam Johnson yet. I am a huge Cam Johnson fan, because, and I'll spoil something that's in this thing. I think Cam Johnson is a top 30 player in this NBA draft. I do. I have him at 30 on my board right now. He is a 6'9" shooter with one of the best strokes in college basketball. I think that guy's just going to make an impact.
I don't necessarily disagree with that. I really do like his pro potential. He's like 22 years old, though, isn't he?
Yes, I think he's actually 23.
Yeah,
but so, I kind of don't care. Like, yeah. he is ready made to be a floor spacer in the NBA.
Yeah, no, and that's the big thing. Like, I think he kind of is what he is, and I don't know how much better he ends up getting.
Let me give you the best comparison I've heard this year.
Straight into my veins. Racial comparison.
Steve Novak.
I like it. I like it. I don't know. My thing with Johnson has always been like, I'm not. He's looked a lot more mobile and a lot more fluid this year now that he's healthy. But I'm just not convinced that there's a lot of athleticism there, at least when it comes from like an NBA perspective. And
yeah.
And that's probably what kind of limits his ceiling. But if we're talking about 6'9" shooters that can kind of get out there and play on the perimeter the way that he can play on the, I mean, he's a two guard. He's a 6'9" two guard, and you can't teach height. And shooting is the most valuable skill you can have in the NBA these days. And that's enough that is probably going to get him. I mean, he's going to be a late first round pick or an early second round pick, and he's going to end up helping out some playoff team as like the eighth or ninth guy off the bench next season. Think that's fair?
Yeah, that's straight up just what I believe as well. I think he is just absolutely going to be a guy who can step in and really help and play minutes, because, like you said, shooting is so vital. I think he's more of like a combo forward. I understand the questions just about size and girth, but I don't really think he has the handle necessarily to play the two. But go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you have a lot of questions about size and girth, huh?
I knew that you were going there. I wanted to open the floor to you to get that one out. You done?
Yeah, yes, I am done.
Yeah, so I'm a fan of Cam Johnson, though, and I think he's an All-American this year is more where we're going with college basketball on this podcast. So I think he is straight up an All-American this year.
Because of his lack of size and girth. All right, let's move on. I do want to, you mentioned this earlier, but we do need to talk a little bit about the Michigan State game. to me, that game and the way that it played out and what Michigan State was able to do defensively kind of drove home the idea of why I don't think that Michigan is among the elite this season. And it's because you can take away what they want to do offensively pretty simply, because they don't really have guys that can beat you, that can beat the switches, right? Like, basically what Michigan State did is anytime there was like a screen with John Teske involved in it, they switched it. And they just said, okay, look, you want Xavier Simpson to try to beat us one-on-one? Go ahead. You want to try to throw the ball into John Teske and let him try to beat Cassius Winston on the block? Go ahead. And they were really disciplined, and they made the switches out whenever they could when Cassius Winston got stuck on John Teske. They didn't really get beaten up that badly on the offensive glass. I think it was there was a 10-minute stretch in the second half where they held Michigan to 4 points. And look, all the credit in the world needs to go to Cassius Winston for that performance. He had, 27-8. He probably could have had 35 if he, hit a couple more open threes and a couple more shots he had at the rim. He was unbelievable on the road against the other best team in Michigan, the other favorite to win the Big Ten, and against his arch nemesis, Xavier Simpson, who is one of the best on-ball defenders in college basketball. So Cassius was unbelievable. But to me, the story of that game and the biggest takeaway that we could have is – boom. That is why Michigan is a team that is, I guess it's their Achilles heel is what you could say. What would you take away from that game?
So I'm trying to think what exactly. So your overreaction here is that Michigan doesn't have the offense essentially to compete at the highest levels.
Well, when I wrote the column this morning, what I said is Sunday's loss is proof Michigan cannot win a national title.
Yeah, I would not go that far.
Look, Sam, it's an overreaction. Just let me get my overreactions out, bro.
I think that what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to put the ball in Jordan Poole's hands more because of exactly what you said about Xavier Simpson, who just can't take advantage, really. And by the way, like, you look at Xavier Simpson's numbers, they weren't disastrous. Like, he had 19 points on 15 shots. He had 5 rebounds, 2 assists, 1 turnover. Jordan Poole, again, 15 points, 2 assists, 1 turnover. Like, he wasn't the issue, or those guys weren't the issue for them. It was their three best offensive players, or really their two most talented offensive players, we'll say, are Jordan Poole and Braz Dakus, right? Mm-hmm. Those two guys combined for 31 points. They did their job. They got their offense pretty efficiently. They even got a good game from Xavier Simpson. The problem for them, and the problem that has been kind of an issue for them, I think, is that Charles Matthews just isn't the consistent weapon that I think we were hoping for offensively, because there's just not a whole lot of reason to guard him outside of 12 feet. And it's kind of the same for Xavier Simpson, right? So Michigan right now, which we associate with this well-spaced, well-oiled John Beilein offensive machine, you have, whenever you play Charles Matthews off the ball, you have a guy playing, sinking into the paint and stopping penetration that way and being a more help-ready defender. You have Xavier Simpson going around ball screens where teams are just flat out either switching them and daring him to beat them, or they're going under it like 16 feet because they don't trust him to make shots and beat them from distance. And you just don't really have any sort of real threat with Teske, because teams, despite the fact that he's made like 17 threes this year, I think teams just don't really think it's real that he is like an elite shooter, and he's shooting 30% right now from three. So I can't really blame them for that thought process either. You need to have more than two shooters on the floor at once. And for Michigan, I just don't think that they have that, unless they decide to start playing like Jordan Poole at the one and start losing defense with Xavier Simpson, or they start to play small and play like Isaiah Livers and Iggy Brazdeikis together and like take Teske out or something. And then you're losing rim protection that way. And honestly, pretty solid perimeter defense because Teske can move his feet a little bit. So I just wonder if this is something of a slightly flawed roster in the way that it works together offensively on the floor.
I would 100% agree. In the preseason, one of the points that I made and one of my concerns with Kentucky was that they had all these guys that were all really good at certain things and really good at filling certain roles. And the problem was that if you looked at who the best like defensive guy was and who the best offensive player was and what their best defensive five and what their best offensive five were, they weren't the same five. Like, you were looking at three or four changes if you wanted to take their best offensive five and their best defensive five. And the thing that they've been able to do is, you know, Ashton Hagans has figured it out enough. And PJ Washington has turned into a guy that is a very, very good two-way player. And probably, like, at this very moment, like, what, a top eight player, top five player in college basketball in terms of, like, how they are currently playing. And Tyler Hero has been, I think, better defensively than I ever thought that he was going to end up being. And they've been able to figure it out and say, okay, our best offensive five is pretty damn good as a defensive unit as well. The issue with Michigan is you look at their best defensive five, and it includes arguably like the best defensive point guard in the country, maybe the best defensive wing in the country, and one of the best defensive big men in the country in Xavier Simpson, Charles Matthews, and John Teske. But you want to put their best offensive five on the floor, and one of those guys has to go. Whether it's playing, like you said, Poole at the point, or getting Isaiah Livers in at the five, or figuring something out so you can get more shooting and more scoring on the floor than what they have. And that, to me, is a problem when you kind of look at like the big picture for what this team could be. Either you're going to have a situation where you're not going to be able to score, or you're going to have a lot of trouble getting stops. And it's just not – that's not the way that I like teams to be built for a run in March. You want your best offensive five to be your best defensive five and to be versatile enough to match up with anybody. And I just don't think that Michigan necessarily has that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Like, do we think that they just have more offensive firepower in them? Like, do we think that Xavier Simpson can maybe turn a corner? Do we think that you know, John Teske can start knocking down shots and spacing the floor at a higher level? I think it's interesting that they've let him shoot almost 60 threes this season. I think it's really smart. I think that Beilein knows that they need that from him because Simpson and Matthews are just total non-threats, and that really bogs down their offense substantially. So it's a very, very fascinating predicament that John Beilein finds himself in, I think.
Yeah, and when we had Snow on the podcast for the Why Your Team Sucks podcast, one of the points he made was last year they were able to play Charles Matthews at the four, and it just does not work as well having him at the four this year, which brings into the issue having him at the three, which is why you see a lot less shooting out there. And another one of the problems is when you switch on John Teske and he's posting up Cassius Winston, you know what he didn't do? He didn't take advantage of his size and his girth, Sam.
That's true. That's absolutely true. this is going to be a running joke now, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
I'm excited about that. This is great.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Tennessee's loss at LSU. What do you make of that? Does it say something to you more about LSU, the fact that they could win without Tremont Waters and with Naz Reid playing as if he was Sam Vecenie? Or did this to you say a little bit more about the fact that Tennessee, you know, maybe they just aren't all that good?
It says to me more about Tennessee's defense. This is a team that, you know, I think that we associated with like really high level defense. They were, I think, a top five, top seven defense, something like that last year. And early on this year, I mean, they started pretty well. They held Kansas to under a point per possession. They played pretty well defensively against a Gonzaga team that is one of the best offenses we've seen in like the KenPom database history. They've actually done pretty well early in the season, figuring out what they need to do defensively to get stops. Now they're not doing that as much. They just don't quite have that. And I know that they're like second or third in the SEC in defensive rating, but I just never feel like that's the case against great teams. Like, you know, Kentucky, they gave up 86. LSU, they gave up 82. You know, Arkansas gets up and down the floor, and I know that was, you know, kind of a blowout game because I bet on them and was very happy with the result. But Arkansas, they give up 87 in 80 possessions, and we just haven't seen them get stops in a substantial way against elite level offenses in SEC play. And I wonder if that is what's going to come back to bite them. Because, like, for instance, like Admiral Schofield's a guy that I thought coming into the year was a really high level defender. And early on in the season, I thought he's pretty solid. He hasn't been great. I mean, PJ Washington took significant advantage against him in the Kentucky game. And, you know, LSU, I thought, took some pretty consistent advantage of Tennessee's guards defensively in this game. Javonte Smart got wherever he wanted on the floor. Skylar Mays just kind of shot over their guards at times. So I think that that's where I am most concerned right now for Tennessee.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's absolutely what it is. They, I think they're, are they still second nationally in KenPom and offensive rating?
Yes, they are. They are behind Gonzaga. It is, Gonzaga right now is something, man.
They're steamrolling everybody, man. They are steamrolling everybody in a WCC, which it's really important to note is probably better than everybody realizes, simply because Gonzaga is just kicking everybody's ass. That conference is much, much better than you probably think it is, even though I think it looks like it's probably going to end up being a one-bid league this season. The one thing I'll say about Tennessee
is it's deeper top to bottom than what it's been since I've been covering college basketball, to be certain.
Yeah. The one thing I will say about Tennessee is this. As efficient as they are, so much of what they do comes off of scoring in the paint, right? They're not a team that shoots a lot of threes. I think they are like 330th in the percentage of points they get off of three-pointers. It's less than 25% of their points come off of threes. And what that means is that they kind of rely on Grant Williams being able to take advantage of the fact that he's so smart and he's so savvy and he understands how to use his size and his strength and the leverage and the angles that he can create. They take advantage of the fact that their big guys are really good at creating space when point guards drive, and they put their head down, they get in the lane, and you have Kyle Alexander sealing off the help man or the shot blocker, and they're so good at doing things like that. But it's also that's if you have a good defensive team that isn't going to give up penetration and that has big guys that can kind of take away what Grant Williams wants to do, kind of like what Reed Travis did in the loss at Kentucky, it makes them a lot more beatable because you don't have guys that are going to win matchups one-on-one. It's kind of based off of the fact that they can run offense through guys. They can create mismatches. Some of it is as simple as, you know, Admiral Schofield. He's kind of like, I know he plays the three for them when they have the best lineup on the floor, but he's kind of like an undersized four. And one of the things one of the things they do really, really well is getting him the ball on the block and let him and say, like, look, you know, you have a 6'6" freshman small forward on you. Go bury his ass in the paint and finish at the bucket. And that's one thing that he does really, really well. And if you can kind of take away some of the advantage they have in and around the paint, which is what good teams are going to be able to do, I think that negates it more for what they do than the typical team, if that makes sense.
So what I would say scares me the most offensively about Tennessee right now for them, and this is kind of turning into another like why your favorite team sucks podcast, and I don't want to step on Snow's territory, but like I don't know where the like consistent third and fourth options are for Tennessee. Jordan Bone has kind of turned into that. He's been pretty good for the most part, I would say, but you're still talking about like a score first guard who is like a 55% true shooting guy, which is fine. It's just not going to be the kind of consistency that you need in terms of efficiency. Like he goes for, I think, 13 on 10 shots against LSU. And then beyond him, though, I don't know who the next guy is. Like maybe Tennessee fans would say Jordan Bowden, right? Or maybe like Lamonte Turner. I'm not really a huge Lamonte Turner fan, to be honest. You know, and I think Bowden is interesting if he's knocking down shots, but there's just not a whole lot else there when he's not knocking down shots. So I just wonder if they have enough to surpass consistently overlooking open three-point shots at the expense of trying to get better two-point shots, because just watching this Tennessee offense, like, it drives me crazy how many open threes they pass up, because teams just sag off of Grant Williams. They sag off of Kyle Alexander often. I think Kyle Alexander actually might realistically be able to shoot some. I would be interested to see LSU. Yeah, I would be interested to see Tennessee run pick and pop for Kyle Alexander a little bit more regularly. I think that Grant Williams, like, for as great as Grant is, and he is terrific, don't get me wrong, he needs to be more willing to pop when he has an open three. It's just a record scratch for their offense if he passes up an open look from three, because it's hard for them to create another consistent look somewhere else on the floor, because they don't have that end of the shot clock, break down the defense and go like right to left crossover pull up guy. They have throw the ball to Grant Williams in the post and hope he gets fouled.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly it. And he is a guy that shoots like 85%, 83%, something like that from the right foul line. And he makes threes. It's not like the stroke looks bad. You gotta let it fly. You know, I wish I was in that situation where you could just let it fly.
What other takes do we got here? I want some more takes.
So the big one for me, is that I think Texas Tech is probably the best team in the country that is not one of the top five when they are shooting. I'm not expecting them to, over the last five games, over this winning streak, they are 58 for 124 from three. Sam, that is a crisp 47% from beyond the arc in a five-game sample. I'm not expecting them to do that the rest of the year. But if they can be close to that level, I think that they are probably the closest thing to one of the tier one teams out of the rest of the country for me. Because what that does when they're shooting that well is it creates the space for Jarrett Culver to go out and be Jarrett Culver. And look, it helps that he's finally like out of this shooting slump and making shots again. But I think when he's at his best, when you kind of let him play almost the four, like they do that a lot where they put three guards around him with Tariq Owens and Jarrett Culver and kind of let him go out there and create and be the point guard when they know they're going to have a bigger defender on him. And it works well. But when he's playing that way and they're shooting anywhere near the level that they've been shooting over the course of the last 3 weeks, they're really, really, really good, because they're the best defensive team in college basketball.
So that's a really good question. Are they so much better than Michigan on defense that Michigan, like we just talked about Michigan having like not a ton of firepower offensively, right? I think I do trust Michigan more offensively than I trust Texas Tech.
Yeah, I mean, you might, but if we've looked at what they've done over the course, there's two reasons. If you look at what they've done over the last 3 weeks, I'm not saying that they're going to shoot 47% from three the rest of the year, but if they're like a 40% three-point shooting team, which I think is certainly within the realm of possibility, especially if guys like Kyler Edwards and Brandon Francis are making their shots in the Sean Corkery, not just the two little guards, Mooney and Moretti. If those guys are making shots too, I think it makes them a little bit more dangerous. And the other part of it, they have a guy that I trust to take over a game more than anybody on Michigan does. And the issue, like Jarrett Culver, I think the most frustrating thing about him is that he has shown, I don't know if he knows quite how good he is, and he kind of has a tendency to not take over games when he needs to, but at the very least, he does have the ability to do that. And I think when it comes down to it in March, you kind of want a guy that is an absolute killer. And he may not be that, but he could definitely take games over and beat and win a game by himself when he wants to and when he decides to.
So, yeah, I agree with you there. Culver is a better player than anyone on Michigan, anyone on most teams in the country. Jarrett Culver is incredible. I don't think that's a crazy take. I will say that. I think it's reasonable. Like, who else would you even throw into this mix? Tennessee, maybe Michigan.
Michigan State.
I probably would not throw Michigan State into that mix. I understand they just beat Michigan at home, but it's really hard for me to get past just where their talent level is beyond Cassius right now. I think they might be like riding high on energy and emotion.
And it's not just that they were able to do something they've never really done what they did against Michigan, and they were able to make some tweaks. And that's the kind of thing where once it's on tape, teams are going to know what's coming and be prepared for it. And other than Michigan,
they ran they ran ball screen the entire game with Cassius. And this is something that they did against Rutgers in the second half, because, oh boy, I bet on Rutgers in that game. And Rutgers was up 7, I think, at the end of the first half, or 7.
Yeah.
And then Michigan State, literally every possession in the second half, Cassius Winston ball screen. Winston either created a shot for a teammate or got to the basket, got fouled, got to the basket, finished. It was just a ridiculous second half performance. They dropped 46 points on, like, I want to say a remarkably small number of possessions, maybe like 32 or something. They're crazy. They were so good just running ball screen offense with Cassius Winston. And they did that same thing against Michigan. And I just don't think Michigan was ready for it.
Yeah. And the other part of it is, what made that? I bet a lot of money on Michigan to win that game to cover. I think it was it like -4? And the reason for that was the matchup with Xavier Simpson and Cassius Winston. Xavier Simpson does not get beaten in many matchups with other point guards, especially on the defensive end of the floor, and especially against Winston, who I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I think it's safe to say that we all kind of knew the storyline that Xavier Simpson was in Cassius Winston's head. And part of why that offense worked is because Cassius Winston went into God mode. And it was like we were playing Mario Kart and he got one of those stars and he just did whatever he wanted over the course of that 40-minute game. And I don't know if that's necessarily something that you want to have to rely on, is for Winston to play as well as he did. But, I mean, that's basically what it's going to end up being. And, look, I think you got to give credit to Xavier Tillman, who was better than I expected him to be. I think you got to give credit to Kenny Goins, who I don't think he has, he doesn't really have all that much talent in his body, but he gets the absolute most out of it. He does everything that Izzo wants him to do. And when he's knocking down shots, he becomes a very useful player. And throw in Kyle Arns and Matt McQuaid, who both were really good defensively on the perimeter in that game and who both knocked down shots. And you have a team that works, but it all depends on Cassius Winston being a guy that can go out and get you 25 points and 8 assists. And that is a risky life to live. Let me put it like this. Cassius Winston can go out and get 30 and 8 against anybody in the country. But if you need him to get 30 and 8 to be able to win games against basically anybody in the country, at some point he's not going to do that. You can't rely on him to average 30 and 8 throughout 6 games in March to win a national title. He could do it in each individual game, but I'm not betting on him to do it for 6 straight games. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that's totally reasonable. I mean, Cassius is great. He's one of the probably 20 best players in the country for this level, right? But he just can't do it all himself. And I think that I do want to bring up McQuaid, because I think he's had a really terrific underrated season. He's shooting 44% from 3 right now. He's a awesome defender. He's a really, really terrific defender.
If I would have told you, you would have said that. When he was a freshman or a sophomore, if I would have told you that, you would have said Matt McQuaid is a difference maker for Michigan State because of what he can do on the defensive end of the floor, how hard would you have laughed at me?
Hard. Extraordinarily hard. But he has worked his ass off to become a legit positive defender. So a funny thing I just noticed, though, on KenPom that is just out there. So who do you think his most similar player is over the course of the history of the KenPom database?
For Matt McQuaid. Give it to me.
Assistant coach Dane Fife.
Really?
In 2002. Yep.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's great. I can't wait to break Fife's balls about that.
So yeah, that's I think that's actually kind of funny. I mean, I was 12 when Dane Fife was in college, but I remember Dane Fife being kind of a shooter that could also defend at a high level. So it's pretty funny that that's what the comparison is.
All right. So the last thing before I think we get out of here, Sam, it's only going to have 6 hours of relevance by the time we actually get this podcast published. But is this the end of the Kansas run atop the Big 12?
Yeah, I think it is. Yes. I've been saying this for basically since the start of the new year. I see nothing to change my thought process on that. I have been on Team Kansas State. You've been on Team Iowa State in this regard.
Originally, I was on Team Texas Tech, and then Jarrett Culver forgot how to shoot. So I got off of Team Texas Tech, and I was on Team Iowa State. Team Iowa State is schizophrenic, so I am back on Team Texas Tech.
Well, here's the thing with Team Kansas State. They don't need to beat Kansas at Kansas anymore to end the streak.
Yeah, no, that's the wildest part of it all.
Yeah, they have two home games against Baylor and Oklahoma that they'll be favored to win. And then they have TCU on the road. If they can beat TCU on the road next Monday, they are in really good shape to win the Big 12. And, you know, Texas Tech, I think, is in an interesting situation as well. They have two road, two homes. The road games are TCU and Iowa State. That last game of the season against Iowa State is going to be pretty interesting for a lot of different reasons, because I think in terms of talent, Texas Tech and Iowa State are probably the two teams I trust most in this league. Would you agree with that?
No, I don't trust Iowa State to do anything other than tie their shoes correctly. but I do think that they are probably the most talented. I would say that Iowa State's the most talented team in the league.
Yeah, I think that that's pretty reasonable. I think that, like, I'm not quite as high on Talen Horton-Tucker as what a lot of people are. Like, some people have him in the first round. I don't have him anywhere near that. I think he should go back to school. I like Tyrese Halliburton. Some people have him in the first round right now. I don't really get that one right now. Maybe down the road, I think that that makes sense. He's a terrific long-term prospect. And then they have Mariel Shayok, who has a chance to get drafted, and you know,
and Wigginton, so, and Wheeler Bab, and Cam Lard. Like, they have a bunch of dudes on that team.
I really like Nick Wheeler Bab too. I think he has a real chance to get drafted as well. So, like, I don't know how this Iowa State team has lost three of its last four to TCU and Baylor. Essentially, they lost two to TCU, but I mean, They have the talent to where they should be a lot better than this.
Yeah, I think, you know, they're young. They have, what is it? I think they have three freshmen in the rotation, and plus Lindell Wigginton, who's a sophomore, plus Cam Lard, who is Cam
inconsistent,
Lard.
Let's say.
Let's just say he's Cam Lard. It's a nice way to put it. So I get it a little bit. I wish there was more, and I wish we would be able to keep this team entirely intact for one more year. But I don't think that well, obviously it's not possible because Shayok and Wheeler Bab are going to be gone, and I would not be surprised to see some people end up leaving this program early. I will say this, though. I think tonight ends up being the biggest game of Bruce Weber's career since the 2005 national title game. And I say that because he has a chance to walk into Fog Allen Fieldhouse as the in-state arch rival and end the streak now. This would end the streak. It'd be done. And he can go in there and he can do it tonight. And in the process, put himself in the driver's seat to be able to win the outright Big 12 title. And I say that. Go ahead.
Here's a question that I have for you. So, Kansas State goes into Kansas, wins, and then wins one more game, right? Like Baylor, TCU, Oklahoma. And breaks the streak. A lot of people are kind of just giving Kelvin Sampson National Coach of the Year this year, and it's, you know, earned. I think Kelvin Sampson has done an unbelievable job with Houston. But is Bruce Weber, like, kind of flying under the radar for this? Like, as the guy who breaks the streak of his arch rival, goes through adversity midseason where they go through a ton of injuries, like, Dean Wade misses some time, and Cartier Jara's missed some time here. And, you know, I think that Xavier Sneed was sick in their last game, and Xavier Sneed goes out and goes for like 30 points or like not 30. What did he go for?
Yeah, I think he only had 12 points, but he was their leading scorer.
Yeah. Like, so, I mean, I'm not saying that Kelvin Sampson shouldn't win Coach of the Year, but Bruce Weber should be in this mix, right?
Yeah, and honestly, I think that I would put Chris Beard in that conversation as well, although I think that he would probably be third on my list. I do have Kelvin Sampson first right now, assuming, but that's kind of with the assumption that, like, Kansas State is not going to win at Fog Allen tonight. Even if that happens, let's say that they lose tonight, but Bruce Weber ends up winning his last three games and Texas Tech loses at Iowa State, so he does win the outright Big 12 title. I think that he has to be in that mix. I don't know.
Yeah, who else I would throw in that mix too?
Who?
Matt Painter.
Yes, like, absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, if Matt Painter wins the Big Ten this year, and there is a real chance that they win the Big Ten because they have home games against Illinois and Ohio State and road games against Minnesota and Northwestern, they legit might go 17-3 in this league.
Yep.
And if they go 17-3 in the league, they're probably winning the Big Ten. And if you told me that a team where Carson Edwards, and it hasn't even been like God mode Carson Edwards, he's been fine. I think he's shooting like 33% over his last, I want to say it's like 8 games or something. And then you're talking about Ryan Klein, Nojel Eastern, Matt Harms, Grady Eifert, Travion Williams, and Evan Boudreau. That team is going to be your Big Ten champion. Shit, man. Give Matt Painter like all the awards. Like,
yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And I think those are the four guys, at least for me, that it's really going to come down to. And like, obviously, you know, Tony Bennett has done really well considering what his team went through last year and what they're doing this season. And you can't overlook like John Calipari being able to turn things around for Kentucky after the start that they had and yada, yada, yada. But coach of the year always ends up going to the guy that outperforms expectations the most. And I think that we just kind of touched on the four guys that have done that. But Sam, listen, man, I think I've kept you here long enough. I do appreciate the time. And if you guys are still listening to this, I really would suggest that you go to The Athletic and you read the series that Sam has up. It's really good stuff. It's really enlightening in terms of the honesty that you are able to get out of some of these coaches. And if you are kind of a basketball nerd and is into that kind of stuff, there is no better source than what you are getting from that content. So, Samuel, I appreciate the time. And I'll tell you what, man, after the end of this podcast, I really don't have any more questions about your size or your girth.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. I'm going to go try and reclaim my room from my cat.
And those questions popped right back up. All right. We got to get out of here before I end up getting myself fired. Sam, I appreciate it.
Later.
Thanks for listening. Follow me on Twitter.
Give me 5 stars.